Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies, who examines the chronology of events which led to the latest escalation of violence between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. Max Richman, President and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, who explains why he believes entitlement programs should not be put on the chopping block in negotiations over the fiscal cliff. And Pablo Benson Silva, an Occupy Wall Street activist involved in Hurricane Sandy relief efforts, who talks about the connections between the movement's protests against economic inequality and standing up to storms made more devastating by climate change. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In a neighborhood in Koriyama, Japan, 150 miles north of Tokyo, hundreds of bags of radioactive dirt and debris from the 2011 meltdown at the Fukushima nuclear complex were buried in a city park. Officials told the public that the contaminated material is considered safe since it was buried below a thick layer of clean dirt. Local activist Yasushi Takemoto wanted a public hearing to discuss the plan to bury the radioactive debris in a park used by young children. The city rejected the request, saying it was not required under Japanese law. The community activist then filed a Freedom of Information request, which revealed that there were 20 other parks and public spaces where radioactive dirt and debris were buried in Koriyama, a city of over 325,000 residents. According to the Christian Science Monitor, the meltdown at the Fukushima complex exposed a culture of secrecy surrounding Japan's nuclear power industry, including lax security and minimal oversight. Yukio Miki of the Tokyo-based Information Clearinghouse Japan says citizens are now more skeptical of government promises. Since the earthquake triggered tsunami and multiple nuclear plant meltdowns 18 months ago, a powerful anti-nuclear movement has sprung up in Japan, forcing the government to temporarily shut down all nuclear power plants. Still, Greenpeace Japan asserts that the major political parties remain strongly allied with the nuclear power industry. 2 years ago, Alabama chicken farmer Gary Staples was pushing for the Obama administration to change the rules for small livestock and poultry farmers. Independent chicken farmers must sell to a small group of powerful packing houses, including Tyson and Purdue. Staples had to pay $1.5 million for new chicken houses to comply with the processing company's demands. Yet farmers typically sign a 60-day contract that can be canceled by the processing companies at any time. For 7 months, Attorney General Eric Holder and Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack held a series of hearings on the abuses small farmers face from large packing houses. The hearings exposed the growing concentration of power in farm sectors such as seeds, pigs, cattle, poultry, and dairy animals. The Department of Agriculture also developed draft revisions of key laws involving livestock while increasing enforcement of antitrust laws. However, powerful interests in the beef and poultry industries fought back, creating delays and eventually succeeding in defunding the reform drive. Since the Republican takeover of the House of Representatives, the White House has walked away from the reform initiatives. According to the Washington Monthly, small farmers' fortunes took a nosedive after the Reagan administration changed the interpretation of federal antitrust laws to allow mergers for reasons of economic efficiency. In 1983, Cargill, the second-largest meat packer, was allowed to buy out Spencer Beef, the third-biggest packing house at the time. Today, the concentration of ownership among the four largest packing houses has grown to a point where they now control over 80% of the market. A week before Black Friday, the launch of the Christmas shopping season, Walmart warehouse workers in California went on a one-day strike to protest growing harassment at Walmart's supply hubs and retail outlets. For the first time in its 50-year history, Walmart faces widespread labor unrest and protest by a number of union-supported groups complaining about work conditions. Seafood workers were the first to walk out in June. In early October, Walmart workers in 12 states launched a one-day strike, and 200 workers crashed a Walmart shareholders meeting in Bentonville, Arkansas. The momentum will continue with labor protests on Black Friday, fueled by anger at the giant retailer for opening its doors on Thanksgiving evening, spoiling the holiday for many workers. The striking workers belong to a number of groups, including Organization United for Respect at Walmart, or Our Walmart, and Warehouse Workers for Justice. They are not seeking union recognition, but action on poor working conditions and a halt to the harassment of activists. Workers have the right to strike over unfair labor violations, a right Walmart has recognized. Historically, Walmart has taken a very hard line against unions. When Texas meat cutters won a union election in 2000, Walmart eliminated that position in all its stores. With low wages and a weak company-sponsored health insurance plan, families of California's Walmart workers are 40% more likely than other retail workers to rely on publicly funded health care and be eligible for public assistance. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
The latest dangerous escalation of violence between Israelis and Palestinians began on November 14th after Israel carried out some 50 airstrikes in the Gaza Strip, one of which targeted and killed the Hamas government's military commander, Ahmed Jabari. The government of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu stated that the assault, in response to days of rockets fired from Gaza into Israeli territory, was the beginning of a broader offensive to destroy the Hamas military's capability to launch long-range missiles that can reach Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. Hamas responded to the Israeli airstrikes by launching hundreds more rockets into Israel, many of which were destroyed in mid-air by Israel's Iron Dome anti-missile system. The deployment of tens of thousands of Israeli troops on the Gaza border in preparation for a possible ground invasion threatened to provoke a broader war similar to the Israeli assault on Gaza in 2008-2009 that led to the deaths of 1,400 Palestinians and 13 Israelis. As the death toll in Gaza exceeded 130 on November 20th, newly elected Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi was attempting to broker a ceasefire between the two sides with support from the U.S. and other nations in the region. While Israel is demanding a halt to all rocket fire from Gaza, Hamas insists on an end to Israel's land, sea, and air blockade of Gaza in effect since June 2007. Your reporter spoke with Phyllis Bennis, director of the Institute for Policy Studies' New Internationalism Project, who examines the chronology of events and the continuing siege of Gaza, which led to the latest conflict between Israel and Hamas.
History starts with when you start the clock. So we could say that this escalation started, and this is now how most of the U.S. press is reporting it, that it started with the Israeli assassination of the Hamas leader, Ahmed Jabari, on November 14th. That would be accurate because that assassination followed a two-day, rather fragile but still holding, ceasefire that was in effect between Israel and the Palestinians, between Israel and Hamas. Or you could go back further, because there had been a great deal of violence across the border in the week prior to that. You could start with the Palestinians having fired on an Israeli patrol with tanks and a jeep at the border on the 8th of November. But then if you ask the question, well, why did they fire? Well, it turns out that morning the Israelis had shot and killed a Palestinian man who was mentally disabled, mentally challenged. They claim, well, we yelled at him to get away from, to leave the fence. It was in response to that Palestinians shot at Israel. You could go back and forth and back and forth on that and pick any day you want and say that's the day we start the clock. But the important thing, I think, Scott, is that all of this takes place in the context of occupation. And people immediately come back and say, wait a minute, how can you say that it's occupied? The soldiers and the settlers pulled out in 2005. Absolutely true. But what that doesn't say is that occupation continued, because occupation in international law means control by another government outside. Not it has to be X number of soldiers on the ground at any given moment. It means that Gazans do not control their own airspace. Israel bombed their airport and controls the skies. Gaza does not control the seas off its own coast. The Israeli Navy does, and it prevents Gaza fishermen from going more than 1 mile out to sea. Gaza does not control its own borders. Israel determines who is allowed into Gaza and who's allowed to come out. It doesn't control its own exports and imports. All of that is controlled by Israel. Gaza remains occupied. It's a different form of occupation. It's in the form of a siege rather than in the form of a physical soldier occupation, but it's occupation nonetheless. And unless we understand it in that context, it's going to happen again, even when we get a ceasefire, because there will be a ceasefire, hopefully immediately. But there will be a ceasefire. The question is, will it last, or will it just be one more step towards the next escalation of violence? Because as long as there is this kind of siege imposed where people have no option, there's going to be violence.
Phyllis, in the battle for public opinion during this conflict, there's a lot of statements from Israel which I think are accepted by a majority of the American public. When Israel says there's no moral equivalence between Hamas deliberately targeting Israeli civilians and Israel's targeting Hamas military installations with precision weaponry with the occasional civilian casualty, although, of course, we know now there's been more than 100 civilians killed to date. But tell us, what's your view on this battle for public opinion that includes this kind of moral equivalence discussion?
I think we have to go back to the question of international law. The Palestinians in Gaza are an occupied population. That means they are to be a protected population with rights guaranteed by the Geneva Conventions of what happens to a population caught up in a war zone. That includes things like prohibiting disproportionate military attack. That doesn't mean that it has to be proportionate in the sense that if Hamas sends a rocket, we send a rocket. That's not the kind of proportionality that the law talks about. It means proportionate in the sense that the risk of killing people or injuring people in the neighborhood, the civilians that surround it, must be worth the gain. So that even if you think that your bomb is going to kill this one guy that you think might someday carry out a military attack against Israel, but the cost of that is going to be killing 20 children, that's disproportionate and you can't do it. Even if there's a value to you, it's disproportionate and it's the price is too high, essentially. That's what we're looking at right now. It's an even-if scenario. I mean, the reality is it comes back again to occupation. Why are there ever any rockets fired from Gaza into Israel? It's because people in Gaza are desperate because the world has ignored them. As the world has taken up the call of the UN for the, quote, responsibility to protect in Libya and in Syria, not very well. I'm not proposing that those methods have worked, but they've at least taken up the understanding that the international community has some responsibility for people whose lives are being destroyed by a government that has power over them and over whom they have no influence. It's precisely what happens with foreign occupation, military occupation, which is what the Palestinians of the West Bank and East Jerusalem and Gaza face. The international community, the UN, the governments of the UN, have refused to do their part. Global civil society has come together with strategies like the movement for boycott and divestment and sanctions as a way of bringing nonviolent pressure to bear to stop the Israeli violations. But in the meantime, people are suffering enormously. And as long as that's the reality, there's going to be this kind of lashing out, unfortunately, with rockets that are terrifying.
That was Phyllis Bennis, director of the Institute for Policy Studies' New Internationalism Project. She is the author of 8 books, including the newly revised edition of Understanding the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict, a primer. For more analysis and commentary on the Gaza conflict, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After the Thanksgiving holiday, President Obama and congressional leaders are set to begin negotiations on finding some agreement on policies that would avoid the so-called fiscal cliff, the congressionally mandated $500 billion in tax increases and $109 billion in domestic and Pentagon spending cuts that are scheduled to start on January 1st. Economists warn that if the fiscal cliff budget cuts are not averted, the resulting economic downturn could lead the nation back into a damaging recession. While Democrats advocate restoring tax increases on the nation's wealthiest citizens, and Republicans call for budget cuts and reducing entitlement program benefits, a recent national poll found that a large majority of Americans reject the idea of cutting benefits for Social Security recipients or raising the retirement age for Medicare. Nevertheless, deficit hawks and many mainstream pundits insist that reductions in Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid benefits must be on the table in the fiscal cliff negotiations. Your reporter spoke with Max Richman, president and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Richman, who met with President Obama on November 13th, along with top labor leaders and progressive activists, explains why he opposes the idea of a grand bargain compromise that would put entitlement programs on the chopping block in the coming fiscal cliff negotiations.
It's our contention that Social Security should not play any role whatsoever in these discussions. And you mentioned I participated in a meeting at the White House last Tuesday. The president held meetings with some of the labor representatives and progressive organizations on Tuesday, and then met with a number of CEOs the following day on Wednesday, and met with members of Congress, the leadership, at the end of the week. And we were with him for about an hour and 15 minutes. And went around the room a few times. Each of us got to the opportunity to state our case, our positions. And one of the opportunities I had, I talked about why Social Security shouldn't be on the table in these discussions. And I made two major points. One is that Social Security is not in crisis. It's not bankrupt. And that's not Max Richman saying that. It's the trustees of Social Security issue a report every spring and talk about the solvency of the program. This program, according to the trustees, is able to pay everybody every penny they're entitled to until the year 2034, and thereafter, with no changes whatsoever, the program will be able to pay about 76% of what people are expecting. And that needs to be addressed, but we're not operating in a situation of where we have to do it in the next 3 weeks. So I got the feeling at that meeting that the president and his team acknowledged that this was a separate discussion, that it would be dealt with at on a separate track, and that would be a big victory for people such as myself and many others who really care about this program and are committed to preserving it. On the subject of Medicare, again, from the discussion, I believe that the president will do everything possible to protect beneficiaries in whatever changes are made in the Medicare program. And the point that I made on Medicare is that I believe we should let the President's Affordable Care Act, Obamacare as it's often referred to, realize some of the savings that are possible in that new law. A lot of the provisions that will provide savings to the program haven't even kicked in and won't for another year, a little more than a year. So it seems to me, and I stated this, that we should see what kinds of savings can come out of that program before we start squeezing it anymore. And I thought we got a receptive audience at that meeting on that point.
Last year, when President Obama was engaged in discussions with House Speaker John Boehner for the Republicans, there was this idea of a grand bargain of major cuts in Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid in exchange for a modest increase in taxes on the wealthy. President Obama has made some noises that he, again, would be open to some ideas, compromise and the like. What assurances do you have, and you can report directly what he said to you at this meeting at the White House that you were part of, what assurances do you have that he won't again turn to this idea of a grand bargain that many people who reelected President Obama would see as a betrayal?
I would not look back in time to the summer of 2011 and say those are the parameters of a deal, because it's a different ball game, a different playing field now. The president, I think, is in a much stronger position. Just look at what his first offering proposal for tax cuts is about double what he was talking about in the grand bargain, from $800 billion to $1.6 trillion. So I think there were a lot of leaks, Mr. Woodward's book and other sources about what was up for grabs, but what I've been saying, that was then and this is now. We're in a different environment, and I believe the president made a lot of commitments in the campaign to protecting the middle class and protecting seniors. I do think that Social Security will be on a different track. It won't be part of this, and I am hoping that beneficiaries will not be paying the price for two wars that were not paid for and enormous tax cuts. You know, seniors have lost so much of their buying power because their home values have declined, their 401ks have declined. The interest, as you probably know, on a CD is that many of them live on the interest. If they have CDs, it's, what, 0.25%, if they're lucky? So this is a different situation from what we were looking at about 14, 15 months ago, and I feel the president is committed to fulfilling the promises that he made during the campaign, and we're doing whatever we can to support that position.
That was Max Richman, president and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Find links to more perspectives on the fiscal cliff and entitlement reform debate on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Occupy Wall Street and related groups through InterOccupy have taken on a major relief effort called Occupy Sandy in the wake of the superstorm that hit the East Coast in late October. Volunteers in the New York City area coordinated their efforts from two central hub sites in Brooklyn and fanned out all over the city. They assisted people in neighborhoods that were without power and heat some more than 2 weeks after the storm hit, as the November days grew colder and darker. Another dimension of Occupy's Hurricane Sandy relief work was the building of bridges between the movement and diverse communities, where discussions turned to politics and economics. Many people in the communities impacted by the storm and Occupy organizers reached common ground in thinking about the urgent need to address climate change that produces dangerous storms like Sandy, as well as concern that developers may soon move to convert storm-damaged affordable housing units on the shoreline into luxury homes or expensive condominiums. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Pablo Benson Silva, the coordinator of one of two Occupy hub sites in Brooklyn. He talks about how the relief effort was organized, the role of social media, the massive scale of the all-volunteer-run organization, and the connection between standing up to the 1% and standing up to storms made more devastating by climate change.
Our job here is to make sure we match drivers with volunteers and supplies and take it out to different sites that we've opened and the most affected areas. Right now that we're talking about Far Rockaway, Coney Island, Staten Island, Sheephead's Bay. These areas, I just went out yesterday to Far Rockaway and they're just devastated. The destruction, the scale of it is pretty overwhelming. So as the week has progressed, we've been opening up new sites closer to underserved communities. Right now, the big kind of story coming out is that both FEMA, Office for Emergency Management, Red Cross, all these kind of institutional disaster relief players have been kind of dropped the ball. And we as a kind of makeshift network of non-paid volunteers have actually outrolled a network that has rivaled their response. We've been able to get aid volunteers, cleanup crews out into these most devastated areas very quickly. And I think it has a lot to do with kind of social media savvy of the Occupy movement brings to the equation and just kind of the enthusiasm and capacity to do multitasking and being at the same time compassionate, right? And kind of community building experience that Occupy brings to the equation. So yeah, so far it's been amazing, the response in terms of volunteers that aren't necessarily affiliated with Occupy. People have just been are very anxious to help in any way possible. And the good thing about Occupy is that we've been able to figure out how volunteers can, through just quick orientations and kind of self-motivation and initiative, can do very meaningful work in this relief effort. Occupy manages two distribution sites. Need assessments we do with our branches on the ground. We send out volunteer supplies and drivers on a daily basis. I would say during the weekend is when we get most of our volunteers this weekend. We probably process through this site alone close to 5,000 volunteers. I can't even count the cars. We're finally taking track of all this so that we have a better idea of how we're scaling gradually, because this has just been kind of ad hoc operation so far.
Well, is anybody, I mean, I know you're a famously, Occupy is a famously, non-hierarchical organization, but is there anybody in charge, or is it a pyramid, or is it just totally, horizontal?
So I think the way it's worked, actually, is it's been a kind of organic structure that has emerged based on need. I think one of the amazing things about this movement, this operation, is that it's a real meritocracy. Anybody who can bring a broad skill base and who has time to commit to this operation, extended period of time, immediately gets plucked out for organizing and coordination. So yes, obviously we have organizers and coordinators, but it's a kind of step up, step down approach, right? Where people don't get too comfortable in organizing positions, and they're moved around frequently. So there's a lot of turnover. I mean, people have other responsibilities besides this hurricane relief, right? And so we're always constantly switching out coordinators or constantly switching out. So, yeah, I mean, that's one of the amazing things. You can say Occupy is a leaderless, but you can also say it's a leaderful movement, right? And we kind of encourage people to take initiative, and people with leadership skills immediately find a space for themselves here.
I'm staying with some friends my friend has a friend who has a brother who's a what do you call those trader people on Wall Street? He's setting up his own thing with his own money and, getting volunteers to come, but really coordinating it all in the far rock, somewhere in the Rockaways. And he specifically wants to show that he's a libertarian or something, that we don't need government. So what do you think this incredible effort by Occupy, what will that show?
People ask me, well, how is it that, Occupy is now doing Sandy relief? And I think Occupy, since the beginning, has been doing disaster relief. It was doing disaster relief of the financial crisis, right? And getting people involved again in politics beyond electoral politics, right? In terms of direct action on the streets and organizing in their communities. I think there is room for people to do autonomous action, right? And this aid relief effort is an autonomous action, right? What Occupy represents, perhaps, is a kind of new paradigm shift that shows that you don't necessarily always need this top-down approach towards relief and just community organizing more generally, right? So I think, if anything, government should learn from, institutional charity organizations and NGOs should learn from this approach, right, if they want to be more effective.
That was Pablo Benson Silva, a volunteer with the Occupy Wall Street Hurricane Sandy relief effort. For more information on Occupy's relief efforts, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.